Surveillance and the policing of black communities have long been intertwined. The public and private course of violence needed to maintain the slave system produced some of the U.S.'s earliest experiments in policing and surveillance. This is the Still Spying podcast, presented by Defending Rights and Dissent. I'm your host, Chip Gibbons, Policy Director of Defending Rights and Dissent. In addition to offering the report, Still Spying on Dissent, the enduring problem of FBI First Amendment abuse, I've written about FBI abuses for The Intercept, In These Times, Washington Post, The Nation, and Jacobin. I've conducted original archival research into FBI surveillance and liberated documents via FOIA. This is a limited podcast series focusing on FBI political surveillance. No exploration of this topic can be complete without focusing on the persistent and ruthless repression the FBI has rained down on black liberation, civil rights movements, and black activists. This is part one of a multi-episode exploration of the FBI's war on black dissent. On this episode, we'll be focusing on Black Lives, Red Scares. That is, the role of Red Scares in trampling on black movements. Now, historically, the FBI used charges of communism to attack civil rights movements. Even if civil rights activists were not themselves communist, the FBI claimed communists were trying to infiltrate them or influence them, and thus they were valid targets for domestic intelligence surveillance. Using this logic, the FBI created the Communist Infiltration Program, or COMINFIL. The Church Committee called COMINFIL the broadest program for collecting intelligence. This program allowed the FBI to gather intelligence on civil rights organizing. It drew up extensive reports on moderate groups like the NAACP. In 1962, FBI opened a COMINFIL investigation into Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., alleging that two of his close advisors were party members. In October of 1963, as part of this investigation, Attorney General Robert F. Kennedy authorized wiretaps on King's homes and in the office of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference in order to quote-unquote find out about communist influence in the racial situation. Even after Dr. Martin Luther King was assassinated, FBI continued to try to smear him as a communist. When there was early talk of creating a Martin Luther King Day as a national holiday, the FBI gave a briefing to members of the House Un-American Activities Committee to discuss the supposed communist influence on Dr. King. This was designed to give them the information they would need to prevent the creation of a federal holiday honoring Martin Luther King. Now, of course, there were black radicals. Black radicalism, like all radicalism, is protected by the First Amendment. To many, white supremacy and the racial caste system it created were part and parcel of capitalist exploitation. Many of these radicals were internationalists who viewed plunder abroad, exploitation at home, and white supremacy to be interconnected. With the FBI seeking to rid the nation of the wrong sort of political ideas, its Red Scares absolutely hit black radical activists. During World War I, there was immense repression, with the Espionage Act being used to go after socialists and anarchists and others who were insufficiently patriotic about the war effort. The Messenger, an openly socialist black publication, was declared by the U.S. government the most able and the most dangerous of all black publications. The political and literary magazine was banned from the mail, its offices were raided by federal agents, and its editors, Chandler Owen and A. Philip Randolph, were indicted under the Espionage Act. Ironically, thanks to a racist judge who did not believe that Randolph and Owen were old enough or being black, smart enough to write that red-hot stuff in the Messenger, Owen and Randolph were acquitted. During the Second Red Scare, anti-communism and the Cold War were used to hound noted civil rights luminaries such as W.E.B. Du Bois and Paul Robeson. To learn more about the connections between anti-communism, white supremacy, and domestic political repression, and how Red Scares impacted black liberation struggles, I'm going to be joined in our next segment by Professor Gerald Horn. Joining me today for our first of three episodes exploring the history of the FBI's war on Black descent is Professor Gerald Horn. Professor Horn holds the Morris Professorship of History and African American Studies at the University of Houston. His research has addressed issues of racism in a variety of relations involving labor, politics, civil rights, international relations, and war. Professor Horn is a prolific scholar, having penned more than 30 books and 100 scholarly articles and reviews. And the other day on Twitter, I saw a picture of someone who was attempting to read all of Professor Horn's works, and the stack of books was quite large, as you can imagine 30 books are. These publications include his groundbreaking work challenging conventional histories of the U.S. War of Independence, the Counter-Revolution of 1776, Slave Resistance and the Origins of the United States from NYU Press, and his most recent work is The Dawning of the Apocalypse, The Roots of Slavery, White Supremacy, Settler Colonialism, and Capitalism in the Long 16th Century from Monthly Review Press. Professor Horn, we're very honored to have you join us today.
Thank you for inviting me.
So you've written a lot about Black liberation movements in the United States. How has the FBI tended to react to Black liberation movements, and how does that fit into the broader history of sort of state reaction to Black movements for freedom?
Well, the short answer is not very well. You may recall that J. Edgar Hoover, the pugnacious bulldog-like FBI director for decades, got his start, in a sense, by going after Marcus Garvey. Marcus Garvey being the Afro-Jamaican migrant to the United States who built this Black nationalist movement. But by the 1920s, he had run afoul of the authorities, was convicted, imprisoned, deported back to Jamaica, dying in London in 1940. But I think it's fair to say that the animosity of the FBI, at least for a few decades, was generally directed at members and leaders of the U.S. Communist Party. Mr. Hoover had an obsession with the U.S. Communist Party. If you go to YouTube, you can probably find clips of him denigrating and denouncing the U.S. Communist Party. And of course, he even wrote books about the United States Communist Party, one of which, if I'm not mistaken, was called Masters of Deceit, which was his sort of throwaway line to describe these Reds. Of course, one of his major targets was a man who disclaimed actual membership in the U.S. Communist Party, although admittedly he was quite close. I'm speaking of Paul Robeson, who for a number of decades, particularly in the 30s and 40s, was probably the best known Black American on planet Earth. He started off as a star student at Rutgers and then a young lawyer out of Columbia University Law School before discovering he had a marvelous singing voice, which catapults him into fame and fortune, although much of that is attained in London, where he went into self-imposed exile for most of the 1920s and 1930s. But as World War II erupts, he fears that he will be somehow isolated, somehow he'll be behind enemy lines in London, which of course was under very severe attack by Berlin. So he comes back to the United States for a while. He and the United States were on the same page, since both were in favor of crushing the Nazi war machine, 1941 to 1945, not to mention defeating Imperial Japan during that same time and fascist Italy. But things quickly change after World War II concludes and the Red Scare and the Cold War erupt. Mr. Robeson fails to go along with this turn, ideological turn, and thus becomes targeted, not least because he's a staunch opponent of lynching. He confronts Harry Truman in the White House. And as the chief executive's face turns purple in the face of Mr. Robeson's denunciation for U.S. lethargy with regard to confronting lynching, in a sense, at least informally, the word sends out that something has to be done about Robeson. This takes on a new meaning after 1950, 1951, when, along with an organization derided by the FBI as a communist front, speaking of the Civil Rights Congress led by his good friend, William Patterson, Robeson and Patterson file a petition at the United Nations charging the United States with genocide against Black people. Now, on the one hand, this puts the United States in an uncomfortable spotlight. It helps to generate international momentum against the hateful and spiteful system known as Jim Crow. But on the other hand, It leads to intensified scrutiny of Mr. Robeson. And from there, 1950 to 1951, you can say his career heads downhill.
Sure. So I want to back up a minute and ask, what historically has been the relationship between white supremacy, anti-communism, and domestic repression in the United States? You hinted at that the FBI has both animosity for Black liberation movements as well as communist.
Well, although it's sometimes forgotten, even by some of our historians, but the United States was a Jim Crow society. It was an apartheid society. Up until, let's say, 1964, 1965, when the Civil Rights Act of 1964 is passed and the Voting Rights Act of 1965 is passed. And even after that, it morphs into what it is today, a kind of de facto apartheid society, or de facto Jim Crow, de facto segregation, as it's sometimes called. And so what that meant was that the authorities, the FBI, but not only the FBI, oftentimes saw flouting Jim Crow regulations as a sign of, quote, un-Americanism, unquote, or as a sign of radicalism, or as a sign of being a so-called communist sympathizer. That, in fact, was seen as one of the markers of an alleged communist. The fact that not only did they read the Daily Worker, but they may have entertained Black people in their home, for example. So there was a very close and intimate connection between white supremacy and anti-communism. And this, in turn, helps to unleash a tidal wave, a veritable tsunami of repression against those who refuse to toe that ideological line.
So you mentioned that there's sort of been a connection between sort of the FBI's disdain for African-American freedom movements as well as for communism. How then did the onset of the Cold War impact the U.S. civil rights movement?
Well, it was a contradictory impact. On the one hand, as already suggested, the onset of the Cold War leads to a bludgeoning and a marginalizing of some of the more sophisticated radicals led by and embodied by Paul Robeson. You also saw that many of the left-led unions, particularly the left-led unions, which had a sterling record on fighting Jim Crow, were crushed, such as the National Maritime Union, second in command, I should say, by Ferdinand Smith, a Black communist Jamaican immigrant who was then deported back to Jamaica. And so you had this anomaly whereby as Jim Crow begins a slow but steady retreat per Brown versus Board of Education, the U.S. High Court ruling in 1954. Therefore, you see that many Black people get the right to eat at certain restaurants ultimately, where they had been heretofore barred, but because of the crushing of unions, they therefore do not have the money to pay the bill because these unions were instrumental in helping to raise the wage level of Black American workers. And we're talking about a mostly working class community. And I would be remiss if I failed to mention a particular union that was in the forefront of fighting bigotry during that time and suffered as a result, speaking of the West Coast longshore workers who were led by a migrant, an immigrant, Harry Bridges, well-born in Melbourne, who the United States authorities spent a small fortune trying to deport.
The longest-running deportation case in U.S. history. It goes before the Supreme Court, I believe, twice. I want to say twice, and the final time it goes before the Supreme Court, because so many of the justices have been appointed by Roosevelt and had been involved in the Roosevelt administration, they have to recuse themselves because they themselves had been involved in the attempts to deport Harry Bridges, and that they actually had cabinet-level meetings where Roosevelt was present to talk about this case. It's a huge, huge mobilization of state resources against one individual.
And sadly and unfortunately, Bridges has not received his due. I mean, I did a book where Bridges was a major character. I did a book on Hawaii. You may recall the 1930s, Hawaii, this archipelago, was a citadel of white supremacy and apartheid. But now it's probably the bluest of the blue states. And a lot of this has to do with the organizing of Bridges Union and Bridges personally, which totally transformed that entire territory. So that's on the one hand. On the other hand, with the Cold War, the United States is fighting an international battle, an international ideological battle for hearts and minds. The United States is embarrassed because of the fact that its ideological foes continually raise the question of Jim Crow and U.S. apartheid and say, how can this country purport to be in the vanguard of freedom and liberty when it treats a substantial percentage of its citizenry so horribly? So this creates objective pressure for the agonizing retreat of Jim Crow. And of course, in some of the briefs, and if I'm not mistaken, the brief filed by the U.S. State Department in the Brown versus Board of Education case, they explicitly raise the question of how Jim Crow is handcuffing the execution of U.S. foreign policy to the benefit of those who are formulating U.S. policy. So it has a contradictory impact, although in the long run, I would say that this ideological impact, that is to say, routing the left, has been the most destructive aspect of that whole Cold War conundrum, because even with the collapse of the Soviet Union in 1991, this question of ideological retreat that has harmed the Black community so terribly, I'm afraid to say, it continues to persist.
And were there divisions within the civil rights movement about how to respond to the U.S. Cold War?
Well, absolutely. The NAACP, which bills itself as the oldest and largest civil rights organization, formed in 1909, it ousted its founder, W.E.B. Du Bois, the great Pan-Africanist intellectual, in 1948 because he was refusing to go along with the Cold War. The NAACP defamed and basically attacked and sought to undermine Paul Robeson. In fact, I've suggested more than once that NAACP should invite Robeson's surviving granddaughter, Susan Robeson, to a national convention and formally apologize to her and the Robeson family and to Paul Robeson to try to make amends. And that's just the tip of the iceberg, because the NAACP cooperated not only domestically, but I just did a book on Southern Africa, and I point out how the NAACP leadership cooperated with the U.S. authorities in red baiting the African National Congress of South Africa, who, of course, was led for the longest by Nelson Mandela. For the longest, they would have little or nothing to do with the ANC. So once again, I guess you can say that at least the NAACP was able to survive because of this kind of collaboration and cooperation with the authorities. But you don't have to be an oracle or a seer to pose the question, at what price and at what cost were they able to survive, and what damage was done to their reputation, and more than that, what damage was done to the constituency that they were sworn to uphold and protect, speaking of Black America.
And for the more radical groups like the Civil Rights Congress that refused to sort of go along with McCarthyism, what was the price that they had to pay for that?
The short answer is liquidation. The Civil Rights Congress basically was forced into liquidation in 1956. They were part of the so-called Attorney General's list of subversive organizations, which was a kind of, quote, blacklist, unquote. And as I said in my book on the Civil Rights Congress, they were like a fire department that spent most of its time fighting fires at the firehouse. What I meant by that is, supposedly the Civil Rights Congress was set up to fight racist and political repression. For example, a case that the late Bella Abzug, the late congresswoman from New York, one of the cases that catapulted her into notoriety was a Civil Rights Congress case, where she worked with them very closely, the case of Willie McGee. Your listeners may want to plug his name into a search engine, who was a Mississippi Black man who was accused falsely of raping his Euro-American paramour and was electrocuted in public. It was like a public state-sponsored lynching in the early 1950s. And there were numerous cases like that that the Civil Rights Congress was involved in. But alas, they wound up having to spend most of their tiny treasury defending themselves. In other words, like a fire department was fighting fires in the firehouse. They were not fighting fires out in the community. They were fighting fires that were trying to keep them from going under, which they eventually did. And the same can be said for the Council on African Affairs, founded by Robeson in 1937. It was an early anti-apartheid political formation, as suggested a moment or two ago. It was in strict solidarity with the African National Congress. And since the ANC was an alliance with the South African Communist Party, that meant that the Council on African Affairs was bound to encounter problems and troubles, which they surely did. And they, too, were forced out of business by 1956. So basically, you had two choices, I'm afraid to say, in the 1950s when confronted with the awesome power of the state. You could go along with the authorities and cooperate and collaborate with the authorities like the NAACP and survive with a damaged reputation, as the NAACP has, or you could fight back and be forced into liquidation.
That's a disturbing conundrum. I want to return for a little bit back to something you mentioned earlier, the We Charge Genocide petition, because it's such a fascinating document, and I feel like it has gotten a lot of short shrift from history, not just because of the power of the charges it lays out, but because of the number of very interesting people who are involved with it. It includes people I suspect our listeners might be familiar with, like W.E.B. Du Bois and Paul Robeson, as well as people that are unfortunately less known to history, like Ben Davis, an elected Communist Party member to the New York City Council, Claudia Jones, an early theorist of how race, gender, and class intersect, and someone I've written about, George Crockett, who would later...
Oh, good. Yes,
if you want to read his FBI files, they're on our website, rightsanddissent.org. And I also wrote a piece for Jacobin magazine about the FBI spying him. For people who aren't aware of him, he was eventually a member of Congress, but early on he was involved with the Civil Rights Congress and actually went to jail for defending the members of the Communist Party. He's later elected as a criminal court judge on a sort of like proto Larry Krasner type reform platform. And the FBI is actively trying to sabotage him, as the documents show, because of his rulings, including granting bail to quote-unquote Black extremists, which they were constitutionally entitled to. So I just sort of want to return to this document because I feel like it has not gotten enough attention from sort of more mainstream sources. Could you explain in a little bit more detail what the We Charge Genocide petition was? What were the charges it laid out?
Well, first of all, I have to mention Crockett, because I knew Crockett when I was a lawyer and head of the National Conference of Black Lawyers. I was able to get George Crockett to give us a $5,000 donation from his own checkbook, believe it or not. And then I wrote about George Crockett when I wrote about the trial of the Communist Party leadership in 1949, because he was one of the lawyers in that case. And as you may recall, the case eventuated with the defendants going to jail and then with Crockett going to jail.
Yes.
Because of his vigorous defense of his clients. And I should have mentioned when I was talking about Harry Bridges that his union is still in the headlines just a few weeks ago to mark Juneteenth, June 19th, 2020, of course, marking the end, or what some would consider to be the end of slavery, enslavement of Africans in the United States, June 19th, 1865. They shut down all the ports from San Diego to Seattle in solidarity with Black Lives Matter. And I should also have mentioned, to get to your question, that the We Charge Genocide petition was filed at the United Nations. The book can still be found. Certainly it's at law libraries and libraries all across the United States because it's sold quite well. It's a compendium of state violence, mostly directed against Black Americans. And one of the points they mention, which is worthy of note, is that increasingly, and you can still say that this is still the case, the hangman's noose was being supplanted by the policeman's bullet. That is to say that contrary to the usual trend in the United States, where the public sector retreats and the private sector steps forward, with regard to violence against Black Americans, the question of so-called private violence, that is to say the posse that breaks into the jail with the complicity of the authorities and drags out the Black person and lynches that Black person, that what has happened increasingly up until this point is that that kind of private sector violence has increasingly been supplanted by police killing. That is to say the kind of killing that George Floyd was subjected to on May 25th, 2020, when a officer of the state kneeled for 8 minutes plus on his neck. And so the petition was designed to put the U.S. authorities in the dock. It was designed also to put pressure on the United States to do something about its horrific system of Jim Crow or U.S. apartheid. And also in June 2020, I should mention that this notable petition was followed up on when the African Union, headquartered Addis Ababa, Ethiopia, the Pan-African transcontinental body of 4 dozen plus African states, filed a petition at the Human Rights Council of the United Nations in Geneva, Switzerland, following in the footsteps of the Civil Rights Congress, demanding a commission of inquiry into what they call systemic racism in the United States of America. Obviously, this is propelled by the George Floyd killing. And even though the United States on the surface played it cool and acted as if this was like a piece of lint on its shoulder, behind the scenes, press reports have now revealed that they were twisting arms and lobbying furiously. And so therefore, that particular commission of inquiry did not receive sufficient support. But I'm relatively sure that it would be followed by other kinds of investigations by the United Nations, because they've been conducting a number of investigations of the United States of late. And in some sense, as noted, this is walking in the footsteps of Paul Robeson and the Civil Rights Congress.
And there was quite a dramatic ordeal about trying to even deliver it to the United Nations. I believe both Robeson and Du Bois at this point had their passports seized. So William Patterson, who was involved with the International Labor Defense and then Civil Rights Congress, you know, tries to travel to, is it Geneva, to deliver it? And there's this dramatic fight where the U.S. government tries to seize his passport while he's overseas, I think.
Yes, it was actually to Paris at this particular occasion. And once again, it should be underscored, the seizing of passports. This was a particular harmful, baneful strategy used against Black radicals at that particular moment on the premise that they would not hold their tongue while abroad. That is to say, they would continue denouncing Jim Crow. And Robeson said, "You damn right I'm going to continue to denounce Jim Crow if I'm abroad." And that led to the seizure of his passport. It also harmed his career because his income went from the comfortable six figures to the low four figures rather rapidly. He had to liquidate a number of his assets just to stay afloat. But finally, once again, an international movement that included a founding father of modern India, speaking of Nehru, the first leader, first prime minister of India, and his daughter, who eventually was named Indira Gandhi, they led an international movement that put sufficient pressure on the United States to give Robeson his passport back, and he was able to finally leave the United States in the late 1950s. So this was all part of this state-sponsored repression that political radicals had to endure. And as I suggested a moment or two ago, I'm not even sure if the progressive movement in 2020 has yet to recover from that steamroller of repression to which our movement was subjected.
So I guess that brings me to my final question. We look around the nation right now, there is a nationwide uprising against police brutality and white supremacy in response to the police murder of George Floyd. We see sort of an increasing talking about radical ideas. What lessons from the sort of state crushing of the more radical wing of the civil rights movement should activists learn from this today?
Well, I must say I'm not just a disinterested observer. I've been thinking about this a lot myself. And one lesson is that I would hope that instead of turning on those to their left, which is what was the pattern in the 1950s, that our mainstream and centrist organizations would not do that. I would hope they would defend those to their left. I hope they would defend me, for example. But if they choose not to, I hope they at least don't attack me and defame me. That's one lesson, because I think that overall, as I've already suggested, that I don't think the NAACP did itself any favors by attacking those to the left. And then another lesson I would put forth is that I think really one of the most damaging aspects of that whole period, the time of the toad, as one writer put it, was the weakening of unions. Because in many ways, the entire progressive movement is dependent upon what happens to working class people. And what happens to working class people is dependent upon what happens to unions. Even Lawrence Summers, the former Secretary of the Treasury under Clinton, now a professor at Harvard, recently authored a paper where he said that then he reduced it to an op-ed in the Washington Post a few weeks ago, where he said that one of the major problems in the United States is income inequality, and he traced that back to the weakening of labor power and the weakening of unions. And I would go a step further to suggest that if you look at the history of the anti-Jim Crow movement and the rise of a person like Martin Luther King, it's well known that Martin Luther King, one of the reasons he was able to fly from Atlanta to Chicago, for example, and go on all of these political crusades was because of his close relationship to the United Auto Workers Union, for example, because of his close relationship to the hospital workers in New York City. By the way, I used to work for that union. And the fate and destiny of unions, it seems to me, is like the canary in the mine. I'm sure you know the story about the canary in the mine. When toxic gases are leaking, the canary keels over. The miners know it's time to escape. So when unions are weak, that's a very dangerous signal for the fate of a society. Inevitably, it tracks income inequality. And I would also say inevitably, it speaks a nation that is suffering in terms of the expansion of civil liberties and civil rights.
Professor Horn, any day I get to discuss both George Crockett and Harry Bridges is a great day. Thank you so much for joining us. It was an honor to have you on. This is the Still Spying podcast, which is produced by Defending Rights and Dissent. To learn more about our work to defend political expression and expose FBI spying, please visit Rights and Dissent. And this podcast would not be possible without the behind-the-scenes work, which is actually much more difficult than what I do, of our communications director, Quentin Anthony Anderson. This is part one of three episodes exploring the FBI's war on Black dissent. In the next episode, I'll be joined by Jeffrey Boss, who represented the survivors of the raid that killed Fred Hampton, discuss COINTELPRO and the assassination of Fred Hampton.